provide mathematics and derivative physics, and I'd like to welcome you here to the Centre for Mathematical Sciences for a direct lecture. If you're standing, there are some spare seats down the front here, and so can you please take those? So this is a very nice annual event, which we've been holding, I think, for nearly 25 years now, direct lecture. It's a joint effort, if you like, of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Derivative Physics and St. John's College, and I'd particularly like to welcome the fellow students of St. John's who are here today. Very pleased to have you, and we're very pleased that this event continues. Today's speaker is Professor Sasha Polyakov from Princeton, and he follows it. We've had several very prominent figures in theoretical physics over the years, and he's the latest to give the direct lecture, and he's now going to be introduced by Professor Michael Green.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me personally to introduce Sasha Polyakov, because he's been such a hugely influential figure in my own area of research for more than 40 years now, and he's influenced just about every branch of particle physics, string theory, quantum field theory, over that time. He spent about 40 years, the first 20 years he was in Moscow at the Landau Institute, a small but incredibly productive institute in Moscow, and then for the last 20 years he's been at Princeton University. I'd like to mention a few of the things for which he's celebrated. I'm almost certainly going to miss some off because there's so many. So here's a very quick survey. When he was much younger, made major contributions in the earlier days of the connections between the renormalization group and quantum field theory and statistical physics. It was important work in the early 70s. In the years 74-75, he wrote a remarkable series of papers on topological aspects of quantum field theory, pioneering, for example, discovering that magnetic monopole was a solution of Young-Mills theory. A magnetic monopole, of course, had been studied in some more, in some much less explicit form by Dirac many years earlier, so there's a deep connection here between and then discovering instanton solutions of Young-Mills theory, which are crucial for understanding non-perturbative aspects, going beyond perturbation theory, in many systems of interest in particle physics and in statistical mechanics. And in particular, he applied these ideas to ideas about confinement of electric charge in three-dimensional electromagnetism, and as a model example of how quarks might be confined in four-dimensional theories of strong interactions, which has been enormously influential since then. And then he turned his attention, all the while actually, I think he's had string theory at the back of his mind as being an overarching principle. And he single-handedly transformed our idea about string theory in the early 1980s by his insights into the connections between string perturbation theory and two-dimensional quantum gravity. And that also was part and parcel of his development with his Russian colleagues of conformal field theory, which has expanded into an enormous field of interest both mathematically and in theoretical physics. And more recently, he was one of the major pioneers of something which has become all the rage in our subject. It goes under the name of the ADS-CFT correspondence, but he was led to it by trying to understand in some deep way the structure of the quantum field theory called QCD, which is the theory of the strong interactions, and he realized there was another way of looking at it by inventing a dual picture which involved understanding gravity in one extra dimension. So four-dimensional quantum field theory was related to five-dimensional quantum gravity. And that has led to a wealth of developments in the last few years. That's a very brief summary of why we're very pleased to have him here, and I'm sure he's known for his both insightful and inimitable style. So I very much look forward to it.
Well, thank you, Michael, for this very nice introduction. It's enormously exaggerated, but still very nice to hear. I'm, of course, very honored to be here and to give this lecture. Dirac, well, what can we say about Dirac? It's very hard to say anything non-trivial, because you can say many non-trivial things when somebody attacks fundamental problems with insufficient talent. That's an interesting situation, unfortunately very well known to me. But this was not the case of, and that's interesting from the point of view of literature, for example. However, Dirac was an ordinary genius, so he just discovered one half of our universe, antiparticles, and he had enough talent to do this without much effort. I think that's all I can say about Dirac, and of course, our admiration for him is universal. This lecture is supposed to be a popular lecture, and it is always, it's slightly embarrassing to give popular lecture when you see in the audience a number of experts. It's always feels a little uncomfortable. And so I would probably do the following. You see, the title of my talk, From Plato to Quarks and Back, means, as you will see, that some ideas of Plato, in a sense, are reincarnated in modern developments of high-energy physics. But I must say immediately concerning the title and Plato that it reminds me, I read long ago some very interesting lecture by the great mathematician Professor Chern. The lecture was called Geometry and Physics, and he begins his lecture saying that it's a strange feeling to give a lecture where you understand only one half of the title. My knowledge of Plato and the history of philosophy is very, very superficial, and it will be very easy for you to embarrass me with the questions at the end. Actually, here I think, since we returned back, I understand only one third of the title. Okay, so I just, when thinking about this lecture, I tried to imagine that I came to Plato's academy and had a discussion. You know, Plato had discussions with his colleagues, and then he wrote his famous dialogues. There is a dialogue, some of the dialogues are named after the colleagues, like Theaetet or Parmenides and so on, Timaeus, and some of them about the subjects like the Republic. So I just imagined that Plato wrote, there was a dialogue discussion named Quarks. However, he, in order to avoid logical difficulties with inherent to the time travel, this dialogue, this manuscript, actually perished in one of the fires of the Library of Alexandria. So no problem, no logical problem arises. I think Stephen Hawking called this thing chronology protection principle. We begin with trying to explain to Plato what goes on. Let me see what I'm going to do now. This lecture to Plato, I will start, as I do today, with the standard model. In the standard model, Plato also had his own standard model, and the world consisted of four elements: air, fire, earth, and water. These elements, in turn, they are constructed of more elementary objects, triangles. And he identified actually geometrical structure related to each to each fundamental element, like tetrahedron, fire was a tetrahedron, etc. So you see, it's a pretty modern way of thinking, although we don't think that fire is a tetrahedron. However, we certainly have tetrahedrons among fundamental objects like molecules of ammonia. And also, I'm not sure about it, but it seems that he didn't really literally understood these elements like fire, air, and water, and so on. It was just symbols, very much like we say that we have color of quarks, but we don't mean that quarks are red or blue. It's just the way of expression. Surprisingly, more or less most of the events in our world are described by four fundamental elements, although it's somewhat depend on how you count. In fact, there are a little more elementary particles than that, fundamental elements than that, there are a number of quarks, there are leptons, different combinations of these particles make the observable matter. We know that atoms consist of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and protons and neutrons, in turn, are made of three quarks. I give examples here. And as you see, it's not very far from what Plato was doing, just the elements are called differently and come with different combination. But at the end, we will see that there are even much more striking analogies between ancient and modern thinking. There are actually more particles, more combinations, there are many other combinations. For example, you have unstable particle called delta plus plus, which consists of three quarks. Those letters are simply conventions. We just have all these fundamental entities, and we form the observable matter by various combination of these entities. There is one more very important fact about modern elementary particle physics, which came from the study of deep inelastic scattering. Deep inelastic scattering is the process when electron hits the proton and flies away, but the proton is destroyed. There is a huge mass of various particles. And the analysis of these experiments showed a very surprising thing, that quarks inside the proton, those three quarks which we discussed, they are practically free. What does that mean? It means that you assume that they are free. You do the computation, and this computation fits the experimental data very precisely. So there's a very good reason to believe that the interaction inside of quarks inside the proton is almost non-existent. And at the same time, one would think that if there is no interaction, then the quarks would leave the proton and we would see many free quarks in nature. This doesn't happen. There is no such thing as free quark. To explain this fact that on one hand quarks are practically free, practically non-interacting. On the other hand, they cannot leave the proton or a neutron. That is the problem. This is called the problem of quark confinement. Quark confinement is related to the forces. It's certainly, one can intuitively, it's not too difficult to imagine the situation of like quark confinement. You just think that, okay, at small distances, quarks are not interacting, but at large distances, there is some force which prevents them from going far. And that's indeed what happens. The question is how to show that it really happens. And the forces between quarks are related to the objects called gluons. And there are 8 gluons. Each one is very much like an ordinary photon. But there are 8 types of photons. And the major difference between gluons and photons is that while photons are electrically neutral, gluons are charged with respect to each other. Actually, if you have a ray of light, you see it in the dark room with ordinary photons. But you see it only because this light scatters on the dust and in the pure vacuum, you would see the photon only if it hits you. It just there's no scattering, no self-interaction, and so on. With gluons, it's different. The gluons are emitting each other, in a sense. They are sources of each other. And this process is described by the Young-Mills theory. This theory is remarkably similar to the theory of electromagnetism, but it is nonlinear. That's the difference. The electromagnetic wave satisfy the superposition principle, but the wave associated with this strange gluons, it does not. The gluons are nonlinear, and actually, it is very, as I said, it's very similar to electromagnetism. I have to write some formula, but in principle, the logic will be clear even without them. The Hamiltonian H, the energy of electromagnetic field, it consists of two terms. It's the square of electric field and the square of magnetic field. The electric field plays the role. The first term is kind of a kinetic energy of electromagnetic field. The second term is a sort of potential energy. And Maxwell, who discovered the laws of electromagnetism, actually wrote the equations for those quantities, expressing them in terms of what is called vector potential, although it was not it was after Maxwell, but doesn't matter. And the difference between Maxwell's theory and the Young-Mills theory is that you have this nonlinear terms, which I didn't write down here, but they are present. And these nonlinear terms break down superposition. So the waves, you see, the waves of light or on the water, to some extent, when they go through each other, they don't notice each other. They go like apparitions. But the gluons, the waves of gluon fields, they do interact. And as a result of this interaction, what happens is that there are some non-linear quantum effects, which I will describe soon, very soon, which actually change the dielectric constant of the vacuum. You see, when we have a condensed matter, it has, say, some insulator, it has some dielectric constant, so the electric field is modified inside. And it turns out that because of this Young-Mills nonlinear interaction, the effective laws of gluon dynamics are also modified. There is some effective and singular dielectric constant which appears in these laws. And as a result of it, we have the following difference between ordinary electromagnetism and between Young-Mills theory. In electrostatics, we have Faraday's lines of force, which tells you that we have one of the laws of electromagnetism is that the total flux, if you surround one charge, then the total flux of electric field should be equal to this charge. And when you solve the ordinary electromagnetism, the linear electromagnetism, you get this distribution of electric field, which was first found by Faraday. Now, in the case of gluon field, it all changes. The flux line, the vacuum, by the mechanisms which I will briefly describe, compresses the previous picture. So all these flux lines, it's energetically unfavorable for them to spread out around the space. What happens is that they are compressed and all electric flux goes through more or less through a single line. And the cause of, so that's what happens, but how to understand it, how to derive it from the first principle. That's not a trivial problem, and it's not even completely solved problem. It's a problem which solved only partially. In some cases, we can see how it happens. The general idea, and it's the mechanism for quark confinement is highly non-trivial. The mechanism which generates this you see, it's of course very elementary to assume that the dielectric constant is singular and then to derive the law of quark confinement. Derive the confinement, by the way, I should have said this, appears because now the quarks are they are at the end of this flux line, and this flux line acts as a string. And now if we really are able to derive it, then we will see that what happens is that this string, as you try to separate two quarks, becomes stretched, and it carries energy, and so the effective energy for separation at the distance r will be proportional to the length of the string, to r. So we will have, it will be completely impossible to, energetically impossible to take quarks far apart. A single quark, which is, if we imagine that there is a single quark in the vacuum, then there will be a semi-infinite string attached to it. And it will have infinite energy. So it will. That's the reason why the quarks, single quarks, are never observed. But when you have quark and anti-quark, two opposite charges, then they are kept together by the string. And this string actually will be at the center of our discussion today. And then it's very nicely explains why the quarks are practically free inside the proton, because if the string is long enough, it will not be stretched at small distances. When quarks are at small distances, the string will be just will have no influence on their energy. It will not be stretched. It starts acting. The force from the string starts acting on the quarks only when you when you try to separate them. So we will have a nice picture that the force is practically absent at small distances, but it becomes enormous at large distances, the force which keeps quarks together. And the challenge, as I said, is to derive it from the first principle. You see, in this case, we do have the first principles, very well-defined first principles, namely the Young-Mills theory, and we have to derive... we believe that the picture I describe is correct, but the question is how to derive it. Now, the mechanism which is responsible for this is based on quantum mechanics. It's not some classical theory which can describe this. And in quantum mechanics, the fundamental principle of quantum mechanics is the principle invented by Feynman, which is called sum over history or sum over paths. It says that in order to find, first of all, the first part, in quantum mechanics, you discuss probabilities for various transitions from one state to another. The probabilities are absolute value square of the thing called amplitude of quantum mechanics. And according to Feynman, the amplitude for transition is the sum over all possible paths. So basically, what happens is the result of everything which could have happened. You have to sum over all possible history, and there is no single history which leads from A to B, but there is a bunch of histories or trajectories, and you have to sum over all of them. When we deal with classical objects, when the quantum mechanics become... classical mechanics is an approximation to quantum mechanics, and this approximation means that in this sum, the special path, the special history becomes dominant. It becomes dominant, and then we perceive it as a classical trajectory. It's a very precise and nice formulation of quantum mechanics, and which makes things very easy to understand. There are two complementary approaches to quark confinement. As I said, we need several approaches. When you need several approaches in science to the same problem, it's not a good sign. It means that we don't understand it to the end. And that's at the moment is the case. So there are two complementary approaches. Just as it was, we had in the 19th century when Maxwell and Faraday developed electrodynamics, there were two different approaches. Faraday thought in terms of flux lines, in terms of dynamics of the flux lines. Maxwell introduced fields, and he discussed the matter in terms of action at a distance, electric and magnetic fields, and so on. So those flux lines are just the strings which I mentioned already, and we can say that Faraday was the first string theorist. Maxwell, on the other hand, his approach started what we call now field theory. In both cases, we have to use this Feynman principle to get some quantitative predictions about the... the one important object which contributes to this theory it's called instantons, and it represents a very peculiar quantum mechanical phenomenon called tunneling. The phenomenon is that if you have no a classical trajectory connecting two points, like, for example, if you throw a ball to the wall, it does not have enough energy to penetrate the wall, unless it is a cannonball, of course. But, what I'm saying is that even if it is not a cannonball, it still can tunnel through the wall. There is some tiny probability, but very important in the domain we are discussing, that it will tunnel through the wall. And it happens in the following way. We start with the Newton equation. All the time I'm mentioning Cambridge residents. I don't know why. But it's not because of politeness I have to do this. So the Newton equation tells us that acceleration is equal to the force, and it may have no solutions, as we just discussed. No solutions when the time is real. But quantum mechanics orders us to try imaginary time. If there is no transition in real time, quantum mechanics tells us try imaginary time. And then in the wall, as you see from this equation, double dot means second derivative in time. If you change time to I time, if you take time imaginary, then since I square is minus 1, the left-hand side will change sign. And as a result, the wall in real time is the well in imaginary time. And we're instructed to take this into account. We're instructed by quantum mechanics to account for transitions in imaginary time. We also can formulate the whole quantum mechanics as a theory in imaginary time, and we can start. It's not in classical mechanics. It's clear that we deal with real time, but in quantum mechanics, sometimes it's convenient to work with imaginary time from the very beginning, and it's hard to explain quickly in all details, but the resulting theory becomes analogous to four-dimensional statistical, classical statistical mechanics. Incidentally, this is a small digression. This explains why we have antiparticle, why we have Dirac antiparticles. One of the way of understanding antiparticles is we can say that they are positron, again invented by Wheeler and Feynman, positrons, anti-electrons, they move backward in time. Now, when we have imaginary time, we have Euclidean space, motion backward in time is as inevitable as possibilities, as inevitable as motion to the right and to the left. You cannot say that in the vacuum you are allowed to move to the right but not allowed to move to the left. In the same way, you cannot say that you are allowed to move only upward in time and not backward in time. And the correct interpretation of this backward motion in time, it's not exactly like coming back to Plato's Academy, but the right interpretation is that you interpret these particles as propagation of positrons, of propagation of antiparticles. So that's one of the things, Dirac invention of antiparticles, which of course looked completely crazy, I must say, at the time, I can imagine. And many outstanding physicists actually thought it was crazy, and was very unhappy about Dirac's idea. But surprisingly, this crazy idea works. Now, the instantons and Young-Mills theory there, which represent tunneling, it turns out that the vacuum of electromagnetic field is very complicated, and there are many walls separating different vacua, and there are tunneling transitions between the walls, which follow from the equation. You can show that the trajectory, this tunneling equation, which I wrote down for the Newton equation, just equation in imaginary time. Here it takes this form, just that electric field is equal to magnetic field. And this equation doesn't make any sense in real time, but in imaginary time it does make sense, and it describes the tunneling between different Young-Mills vacua. As a result, the picture we are arriving at is that the picture that we have an analog system in four-dimensional space-time, which consists of kind of gas or liquid of instantons, and these instantons, these tunneling events, they occur spontaneously anywhere at any time. They are localized in time. That's the reason for their name. The result of it is that they exert forces on the quarks and prevent these random forces acting on the quarks, prevent them from propagating. And we cannot have a free propagating quarks. This is very similar to the fact that when you have a piece of metal, it conducts electricity, of course. But if you put too many impurities in this piece of metal, these impurities, when poor electron trying to propagate, it's acted upon so many random fields, contradictory random fields, that it just gets localized. It doesn't propagate. It's called in condensed metaphysics Anderson localization. And something similar, even on a technical level, happens to quarks in the field of instantons. This picture, which I describe qualitatively, can be made precise in a number of theories. Here I become a little bit more technical. There are so-called n equals 2 supersymmetric theories in 4D and 3D gauge theories with Higgs fields, etc. In any case, what I'm trying to convey is that we have some analog system describing quark confinement, and that it is very similar to localization. But this picture, and we believe, actually, I think most people believe that this picture is qualitatively correct. However, we want more than that. We want quantitative theory, and preferably exact quantitative theory. And this exists only in special cases, not in the case of quantum chromodynamics, which we are mostly interested in. So the most interesting question remains unanswered. And for this reason, So what I described so far was the field theoretic approach. This field theoretic approach gives, as I said, a reasonable picture, but we have to supplement it with a string theory approach to get more information. String theory approach also, we hope it will solve the problem. It didn't solve the problem yet, but it made a lot of progress have been made, and that's the reason I'm now. And it has also the interest of itself, the interest which I will discuss. So in string approach, we deal with the Faraday flux lines. The history of a flux line is when you propagate the flux line in time, you get a surface. It sweeps a surface. And according to the Feynman principle, you have to allow all possible surfaces. So in other words, you have to develop a theory of random surfaces. Just as point-like particle, when it propagates in time, sweeps a trajectory, and we have to learn how to sum over all these trajectories, and that we know quite well, how to sum over random paths. Here, we have to sum over random surfaces, and this is much more difficult problem. I will show you what it leads to. The classical action which enters in the Feynman principle is equal to the area of this surface, and the minimization of this surface is very well, if you use a classical approximation, you have to minimize the action. You have to take the minimum of the action or extremum of the action. And this is a soap film problem, when you have a shape of the soap film bounded by some wire or something like that. String theory is a theory of a quantum soap bubble. Some people say that it is a soap bubble, but they're wrong. So how to build this theory? I shall very briefly explain how the theory is constructed. A classical string propagates by what could be called the Huygens principle. Probably the first person who was not a resident of Cambridge. And the principle says that the string moves, each bit moves perpendicularly to the neighboring bits, and it moves as a free particle. As a result, the Hamiltonian, the energy, is just the sum of the energy of the bits, but we have to impose the condition that the momentum is always perpendicular to the string itself. So each source, if you have a certain shape of the string at the moment zero, in order to find its shape at the next moment, you have to simply propagate, you have to split the string onto bits and propagate each bit according to the rule I discussed. Now, the classical string in D space-time dimensions, clearly this means that the number of independent oscillations of the string will be D minus 2. A string is infinitely thin, and there are no longitudinal waves. It just oscillates orthogonally to itself. The other types of waves are always also possible in other types of strings. For example, one can consider string bits which carry spin also. In this case, we will have not only oscillations of the shape of the string, which may be called phonons, but also the thing which in condensed matter physics called magnons, namely the spin waves. So with this spinning string, it looks as a barbed wire. And the barbs oscillate and the shape of the string oscillate. It's a very fascinating feature of these strings is that if each string bit has a spin 1/2, there could be both odd or even number of barbs of bits, and as a result you will get the states which can be bosonic or fermionic. And that leads to supersymmetry, and the whole thing is called superstring, and that was a great discovery that this superstring is consistent. The ground state of the closed string, it has spin 2 and it is massless, while the open string is massless and has spin 1, and so it relates us to massless spin 2 particle means that this is a theory of gravity because graviton is massless particle with spin 2, and the only way it can interact consistently is by theory of gravity, and spin 1 means that there is a gauge field. One of the main achievements of string theory is that, although it's not central to my talk, but it's very important nevertheless, it gives us a consistent quantum theory of gravity, because by some miracle it contains this spin 2 massless particle. Now, under naive quantization, the wave functional, in case of string, you have instead of wave function, the wave functional. This wave functional will reflect those degrees of freedom, and it will depend on the shape of the string. However, this conclusion is correct only in certain number of dimensions, which seems to be a problem, because we started with trying to describe a three-dimensional world. It seems that if we quantize string in the conventional way, we have a certain critical dimension. But for the non-critical dimensions, for example, for dimension we are interested in, dimension 4, there is one more mode of oscillations. In fact, by the result of some analysis, you can show that since the infinitely thin string becomes somewhat fuzzy because of quantum mechanical effects, it oscillates because of quantum mechanical effects, you get longitudinal wave propagating along the string, not only transverse string. And moreover, what's quite fascinating, this can be interpreted as if the string is critical, but in d plus 1 dimension. So it can be interpreted, this extra mode of oscillation can be interpreted by saying that confining string lives not in 4 dimensions, but in 5 dimensions. What does that mean? You can say it's just the way of expression, and to some extent it is, but it actually makes much easier to understand the qualitative properties of this string. You can always reinterpret it. If you try to avoid 5 dimensions, you can in some clumsy way do it, but replacing it by some other degrees of freedom, etc. But it's the natural thing to do is just to view, to say that although we are describing 4-dimensional world, 3+1-dimensional world, 3 space and 1 time dimension, we actually have to add one more dimension, and then things become natural. To give you the analogy to give you the spirit of what I mean, I can say, you look at this picture. It's something complicated and difficult to describe what it does, difficult to notice what it is. However, when you this thing is what is called tesseract. It's a projection of four-dimensional cube. So when you say this, you, instead of all these complicated motions, you simply say it's just a four-dimensional cube which is rotated, and that's a great theoretical progress because you now can predict things. You can predict what happens if you deform it a little bit or if you change the angle under which you see. And it is also intellectually very satisfying. On one hand, you have this something which is impossible to understand, and then you replace it by four-dimensional cube, and things become simple. And that's in this way, in the same, in a very precise way, this five-dimensional picture of quark confinement has the same status. Now I will have to be a little more technical. One has to decide in which space the quarks, this gauge string, is living, and and it turns out that the only possible metric which can describe this those things is the metric which is written here. This describes a warped five-dimensional space. The warp factor, the value of the warp factor, comes from the consistency condition for it's not unknown. It satisfies certain equations which follow from the consistency condition of string dynamics. As a result, we are coming to what is called gauge string correspondence. And in this case, the closed strings describe neutral objects, while the color charged gluons are described by the open strings. The open strings have a gauge particle in this spectrum, but typically the open strings have also infinite tower of higher excitation, and we want to describe a usual field theory. We don't want it. And the only way to eliminate this tower, we need to do something with the metric, and that is a strong condition of this five-dimensional space on this warp geometry. This warp geometry must contain an infinite blue shift. If the massive spectra is blue shifted to infinity, the only states which remain of the string are the gluons. So in this way, it's technical, and if you never heard about it, one can't understand it. But the outcome of this is that you find the warp geometry. The warp geometry, which precisely describes the gluons of quantum chromodynamics of the Young-Mills theory. So we have a string theoretic. We have not succeeded to do this in all cases, but that's the goal. But in certain cases, we did succeed, and we have this five-dimensional string description of the four-dimensional world. Of four-dimensional quarks. Basically, that's the idea is that in the case of warp geometry, the effective masses are rescaled, and if this factor turns to infinity, then in this geometry, strings are equivalent to field theory. If there is no blue shift, then there is no relation between strings and field theory. It's string theory becomes, it has too many states. The most explored case is so-called, again, I'm getting technical for a short while once again, but I promise to get rid of technicalities a little later. You will feel that I'm actually will be too non-technical in a short while. I promise you that. Which means I will get involved in wild speculations. The most explored case is the so-called n equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theories, which has conformal invariance, and that's, this symmetry defines the warp factor. And as a result, we find that in this particular case, very beautiful fact that the four-dimensional flat space, quantum chromodynamics, interaction of quarks in four-dimensional flat space, is actually described by the five-dimensional Lobachevsky space. And our four-dimensional space is located at infinity of this Lobachevsky space. The infinity of five-dimensional space is, of course, four-dimensional. That's getting too technical probably. There's a kind of isomorphism between observables of gauge theory and observables of five-dimensional gravity. What happens is quite fascinating, because we get an identification, an isomorphism between geometry and alphabet. Basically, the operators, you have symbols like electromagnetic field strength, derivatives, etc., and you have you form sentences out of this alphabet, and each sentence represents an observable, and this observable has its counterpart in geometry. So there is actually, at large curvature, geometry is not a natural language. It degenerates into this alphabet. We have people actually thought for a long time whether at small distances, people realize that it cannot be that at small distances geometry continues to be continuous. But what it was, discrete, whatever, many, many different versions have been proposed, but it seems that we now understand that it's just not geometry. It's where geometry degenerates into linguistics, in a sense. There's a very interesting view of Riemann, which, unfortunately, don't have much time to explain, I quote from his famous work here, that in a discrete manifold, the principle of metric relation is already contained in the concept of the manifold. Now, the experts, I can say that the way I finally understood, I never understood this phrase very well, but I finally understood it when we realized, when we learned that geometry can be described by the alphabet and by the matrix models. I will be happy to expand on it, but not now. And this is kind of a prophetic phrase. Actually, there are many. This lecture, inauguration lecture by Riemann, is a concentration of genius, is absolutely fascinating. There is only one formula there, or two formulas, but the intensity of thought is absolutely fantastic. So, as a result, we see that our four-dimensional world is a kind of a projection of the five-dimensional string theory. As Plato, now I'm returning back, so high time to return back, actually. But back to Plato, I mean. What Plato wrote 25 centuries ago was that was his famous parable of the cave. He said that when people we in perception of our world are like people who can see only the wall of the cave, and they see only their shadows or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. We'll now have a small improvement of Plato, that the cave is five-dimensional while the wall is four-dimensional. But the fire is probably the same. Often called holography, but for some reason interesting to the experts on the I believe it's not a holography, it's photography. These methods are very they're very practical. We are not doing philosophy. We're just trying to calculate things like deep inelastic scattering or quark gluon plasma. There is another thing which very easily understood in string terms, that when you if you warm up the collection of matter of quarks and gluons, there is a phase transition to deconfinement. So you get what a completely mixed quarks and gluons called quark-gluon plasma, and the challenge is to evaluate its physical quantities. And these methods, these so-called holographic or photographic methods, are very useful for this. But that's a matter for the experts. We can actually move in the opposite direction and try to use this experience which we reached to describe not quantum chromodynamics, but geometry, quantum general relativity, quantum gravity. And turns out that we can try to introduce the wave function. Actually, I think the wave function of the object called the wave function of the universe was explored by Hart and Hawking long ago. But now we probably have a little better understanding of it. I actually called it not so much the wave function of the universe, but of everything. So it the abbreviation seems appropriate. Then we can relate this wave function to the Young-Mills theory again, and then to interpret it as a Young-Mills, to find the Young-Mills theory which attempts to describe the four-dimensional quantum gravity. And then we can see many interesting things, but this is all speculation at the moment. Unlike what I said before was not speculation. There were a lot of hard stuff, well-established stuff. This is a speculations, the wave functions probably nonlinear, Schrödinger equation nonlinear, etc. There are many more things which I would discuss, but I would rather pass to the. I have to keep my promise and drop all technical stuff and start some wild speculations. But it will not be my own speculations. I don't feel secure enough to proceed with my own speculations. So I will tell you about the speculations of various great people, which are completely wild. It's this part of the lecture should not be taken too seriously. I really don't take it too seriously, but it's fun, I think. It's interesting to see how... You see, my point was that to find some... how various great minds... I was not interested in the cases than people who delude themselves, emerge in mysticism, etc. But I was interested in the cases when great minds saw the world in a very unconventional way. And then, and I will give you a couple of examples. Because the reason why it's related to the previous part, in the previous part, this five-dimensional view of the world is pretty weird by itself, but it seems to be reasonably well established. So let's try to see if there are any more weird things which can be said. For example, Pauli was very much interested in relation of psychology and physics. He wrote that he tried to find some analogies between the concepts created by mathematics, like Riemann surfaces. He wrote that they lend themselves to a symbolic representation of the concept of time that is linked to the developing consciousness of the new focal point described as the ego. I cannot say I understand what it means. but it looks fascinating to me. Probably he means that when you have if you somehow represent reality and psychology by two sheets of the Riemann surface, then ego is the branch point where they connect. Maybe not, I don't know. But that's just the beginning. Now I'm... now let's go to another great scientist, Swedenborg. He wrote an interesting text about heavens and hell. The text is very detailed. With Swedenborg, it was one of the great minds, his writing is very concrete, very clear, and very imaginative. I would compare it with Dante's Divine Comedy. It's equally interesting to read. In particular, he wrote that angels don't have concept of time and space. Instead, they experience changes of internal state. That's precisely how we describe quantum gravity. For those of you who know what is Wheeler-DeWitt equation, it represents precisely the changes of internal state, and not there's really no concept of time in quantum gravity. So it's kind of I was amusing myself reading this. If we go to Isaac Newton, as you know, he wrote a lot of theological texts, and I think I can understand why. What was the motivation by reading various things? You see, when he looked at the he studied celestial mechanics, he had a huge number of experimental data coming from Tycho Brahe, and also he knew the work by Kepler, etc. And he managed to predict the future for the planets. I think it was very natural that the next step is to predict the future for the human beings. But there was no experimental data. And he was looking for experimental data. The experimental data, natural one, was, of course, the Bible and the prophets. And so he analyzed the prophets and their predictions in a very detailed and scientific way. And he explained that there are two languages, there are two parallel languages which should be taken into account, etc. On the other hand, if we go back... to modern ages, Steven Weinberg wrote rather bluntly about all these things. He wrote that the more we learn about the universe, the more pointless it appears. I'm not so sure about this, but it's also an interesting view. And I will finish by reminding you, I think it's a good story about Galileo, Kepler, and tides, which shows you how you should be really careful in following authorities and great minds. Mm. You see, Kepler had an idea, followed the idea that tides are related to the motion of the moon. And Galileo, who was in very good relations with Kepler, he was outraged. He said, how can you write this nonsense? It's not worth of you. It's total absurdity. I think when we declare those views, which I presented before, as total absurdity, we should remember this story. So even great people make errors. Okay, so let me finish here, because otherwise the speculation will be so wild that it will become unacceptable. Okay. What I mean is that you can. We have a correspondence between quantum gravity, say, in five dimension, and gauge theory in four dimension, and we have certain set of observables in five-dimensional case, which translates in a set of observables in four-dimensional case. However, I will have to write it down. After all, I can write some formula. There are observables in five dimensions which cannot be translated into four-dimensional case. Namely, when we look at if this is four-dimensional case, what we know is that when we have scattering of particles in five dimension and calculate the S matrix in 5D is equal to is Green function of Young-Mills in 4D. This is a very special type of observables when the quanta goes to infinity. This is infinity of five-dimensional space. Now, if you look at the operators in 5D of a different kind, for instance, you can take a square of curvature and integrate it over the five-dimensional manifold, and you can take expectation values of these objects. This kind of objects don't have any representation, at least I don't know the representation in terms of Young-Mills theory. So it's indeed a projection, in my view, and not a complete restoration of five-dimensional picture. Well, I am concerned, but not precisely with that. I think it will be, we will find we will find some way to test things. For example, there is a huge area of cosmology, and we will see new things in LHC. So I'm not concerned that there will be nothing, that there will be no data to feed. I think there will be a lot of data to feed. What I am concerned about, but still I am concerned about mathematization of physics for the following reason. You see, mathematics is very seductive. It has its own style, and if you start learning in deep details some serious field of mathematics like algebraic geometry or topology or whatever, you almost unwillingly begin thinking as a mathematician. And that's not the style which is effective in theoretical physics. So I think it's more and that's the danger, and that seems to me. Usually, I would rather see some ignorant theoretical physicist inventing some concepts which later turns out to be connected to what mathematicians are doing. He invents these concepts. It's like a bit like Molière character who never knew that he is speaking prose. In this way, mathematics will also profit, and the physics will profit, because mathematicians are pretty good in what they're doing. We don't need to help them, you see. but we can have another view, you see, a different point of view on their problems, and this may be really helpful for both sciences. Not that I'm calling for ignorance, but I'm a bit concerned about over-sophistication.
By mentioning that in addition to this lecture, we've been having memories of Dirac in other ways this year, one local and one more much international. So the local thing is that the department owns a bust of Dirac, which used to be on display in the department library in Silver Street, made by Gabriela Bolivash, and it went into hiding in my office for many years. And it was rescued at the last minute when we left Silver Street. I kept it. But it's now been put on display again, thanks to Mick Young's nice technology. It's on the top of the Pavilion B, the Radical Physics Pavilion, on top of one of the staircases. So those of you who are not familiar with the Pavilion B are welcome, not either today or any other time, to wander upstairs in Pavilion B to look at this rather nice bust of Dirac that's now on display again. And the more international event is that earlier this year there was a biography published of Dirac called The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac, and this was written by actually Graham Farmer, who's made himself known by asking questions today. And Graham has kindly put an autograph in here. And we'd like to present this book to you as a memorial of this lecture, and Graham's written to that effect today.
Thank you very much.
I didn't realize till the last moment what you are going to do.
No.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I think there's tea now. Is that upstairs if anyone would like to stay? So tea and the Drac bust, if you'd like to see it. Not more than 10 people should stand on that stage at the same time.